You certainly want to have a positive environment, and you're not looking for internal-based trolls to spoil that cultural piece.
No trolls on Mike. No chemistry.
We don't have
trolls
on Mike.
That's right. That's only right. Positive and happy wizards.
Only happy trolls.
Happy trolls.
Like
with the funny hair. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, I love those.
Hi, I'm LC, and I'm a storyteller. I'm a passionate chemist who loves to explore and tell stories about how chemistry can change the world.
And I'm Danny, and I'm LC's spirited chemistry co-host. I love to bring high energy and positivity to my chemistry, but also my life. Welcome to the Farm to Table podcast.
We're two chemists working at the pharmaceutical company Merck in the U.S.
Also known as MSD everywhere else in the world except Canada, the U.S., and its territories.
And this is a podcast where we'll tell you stories about the people and the science behind the papers published by our chemistry group.
Each week we'll pick one to two papers that we recently published and introduce you to the key people behind it, and also ask them to give you a unique insight into the story behind it.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Farm to Table podcast, season 2. Today we're here with Doug Bashour and Izzat Rahim to talk about their 2022 JMed Chem paper, Building a Culture of Medicinal Chemistry Knowledge and Sharing. So welcome to the pod, Doug and Izzat.
Welcome. Woo!
Thank you for having us.
So let's do some introductions because our listeners may not know everything about you, and they may not after the introductions as well, but we'll at least give them a little sneak peek. So Doug, how about you start? Who are you? What do you do at Merck? And maybe a fun fact.
So I'm a medicinal chemist here at the West Point site. I've been a project leader in both infectious disease and neuroscience space. And I've had a long-standing set of interests in the organizational learning, which had been unintentional when I had started out, and also a lot of interest in the hit-to-lead space. And a fun fact about me is I love to grow vegetables at my house, and I really enjoy homegrown lettuce. And my children only wait all year long to wait and eat my tomatoes when they grow. It's the only tomatoes they'll eat.
Wow.
That's impressive.
What about this lettuce? Like, what's your variety that you specialize in?
I love to hit the varieties you don't get in the stores. And one of my favorites is buttercrunch lettuce. It's really soft in the mouth, and it has a great feel to it. So
I don't think I've ever had that. I'll have to steal some next summer. All right, Izzat, how about we go to you next? Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do at Merck, and any other fun facts you want to share with the audience.
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, LC. Thanks, Danny, for the invite, the intro. I'm also a medicinal chemist here at Merck, based at the West Point site in Pennsylvania. And like Doug, I've spent my time here in both the neuroscience and infectious disease and vaccines therapeutic areas. I currently have a role where I have responsibilities at the strategic and scientific interface of our department, discovery chemistry, and our biology counterparts in infectious disease and vaccines specifically. I've been a part of many programs over my time here, orexin, PDE10, and a range of HIV and antibacterial and vaccine programs as well. I'm a passionate mentor. I love mentoring and have taken part in programs both in and out of Merck to really try to impart my experiences, my knowledge, and my love of science to those inside and outside the organization. And a fun fact, even though the folks who you can't see me, but the folks who can, folks who know me, and based on my name, you might not be able to tell, but I was born in Denmark, and I speak fluent Danish as well. So my looks and my name wouldn't give that away easily, but that is my fun fact.
So how often do you actually get to practice your Danish these days?
Not often enough, as my mother would say. So my mother actually lives pretty close and babysits my kids. So I do see my parents a lot. So I do practice with my mother. And we do have a small handful of Danes within the organization here. There's actually a couple of them in building 14 here at the West Point site in our pharmacology and neuroscience department. So a little bit of practice on site, but primarily with my mother.
How would you say farm to table in Danish?
Bundegård til bord.
Ooh. Nice. Okay. I like that. We just picked up some Danish listeners.
Yeah, if we see a spike in our Danish listening experience, we'll let you know.
Okay, so let's dive into this paper about knowledge exchange. And so, Doug, first, the question to kind of tee up this topic. The focus of this perspective was on leveraging collective wisdom and learning through knowledge and sharing exchange to ultimately accelerate drug discovery. So I guess what inspired you to write about this topic? It seemed like it was a passion project of sorts. So just give me a little bit more background here.
Sure. So as scientists, we're all fundamentally in the business of knowledge. And it's central to our work. And in particular, in the drug discovery space, there's a lot of knowledge there that's not always easy to access. And those timelines to getting that knowledge can be pretty long. And what we wanted to do, and that's where that kind of drives the origin of the interest. And what we wanted to do is to try to figure out and share with everybody how we thought about these sort of problems that we think are somewhat unique to drug discovery. But share how we had thought about that knowledge management and capturing across the organization, because we stumbled through that ourselves for quite a long time, and what we came to, what we think is a steady state of a way to try to capture that knowledge, some of that knowledge that can be really hard to capture.
Is this problem, do you think, unique to discovery chemistry, or does it span beyond?
So I like to think that we all think that everything's unique to our organizations, but I don't think it is. I think what it's unique to, it's not unique to drug discovery. What is unique, one of the, some of the problems that are unique are that it's a highly cross-functional, and the knowledge sources that you are looking to capture are really challenging to mine. Like, we hear a lot and we talk a lot about artificial intelligence and machine learning, and that's absolutely and really, really important to try to mine data that way. But in particular, there's an apprenticeship component to medicinal chemistry. And I think when I had started many years ago, I was surrounded by a bunch of folks with 40 years of experience. And it was a trove of knowledge. And unfortunately, when those folks retired, that knowledge was lost. And I think trying to figure out how to capture that was something that became that unintended passion.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, because I think, especially when you join a new organization, and I think the graduate students listening will also sort of resonate with, you join a lab and there's someone that's been there 5 years, right? And they seem to just know all these things that you can't really learn by, you know, watching a video or reading a book. There's like a lot of intuition and sort of built-in knowledge, right? So this really resonates with me. Like, when I first joined process chemistry teams and started doing process chemistry, there was all this stuff that I didn't know that I should have known. And I actually don't think it's useful to learn in a book either. I don't know. Izzat, you have other perspectives on this you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, I agree at a high level with Doug that this is not at all unique to discovery chemistry. And I've had a number of experiences at Merck, you know, at what we call cross-functional interfaces or through collaborations with colleagues, you know, across the organization. And we all have. And, you know, I think that each organization does things a little bit differently within a large company like Merck, and the challenges that they face around knowledge management, knowledge sharing are different, and there are different constraints around IP, constraints around regulatory considerations, geographical or organizational constraints, database access. You know, these are all things that each functional area, you know, has to deal with. But I think the opportunity is there for all of these functional areas to really elevate their knowledge sharing capacities. If you have a colleague in a different functional area that has a challenge, the quicker you can connect them to another colleague that is able to point them in the direction of a solution to that challenge is going to elevate the entire organization. So I think Doug talked about, you know, issues within departments as well as issues that span outside of the departments. This is such a cross-functional, opportunity here that I think if we can get it right first within one function and then scale that more broadly, you're going to put everyone, all of our programs, the pipeline on a better path moving forward. I would say though that scale of the organization is a challenge here, right? You're working with a very large organization at a company like Merck, so I would make the assumption that smaller might make this a little bit easier, but it's something I'd like to learn more about. But that's definitely a challenge we face, is how big we are at a company like Merck.
One thing that's also, I think, and a contributor to this is that I think, like you had said, Elsie, when you think about going into a graduate group, you have that body of knowledge that you're extracting from your colleagues. And when you have an applied science that's tied to business objectives, like the pharmaceutical industry, and where our primary commodity is intellectual knowledge and intellectual capital, that really, I think, makes the ability to share that broadly, in particular across companies, like we do in peer-reviewed literature, a little bit more challenging. And it's like, I think about that, and I think a great analogy to that is either the Coca-Cola or KFC secret recipe, right? So we are carrying with us many different secrets, and the ability to extract those from each other and share them with each other is really important in that applied science field, maybe a smidge more so than in the more basic sciences that are shared differently.
So I guess to follow up on that, there's this really amazing statement in the paper that really caught my eye, was that it is much easier to share learnings or learn from the external environment than it is from the internal environment. Because if people take the time to write a review, or they go to a conference, or they can, dare I say, write a book chapter, which I think all of us, have done and probably regret afterwards. it is actually something that people find useful, because then that data can be mined. And so I guess, what are the benefits, Doug, that you feel about tapping into the internal space as well?
That internal space allows you to really talk without a filter. When you're thinking about those peer-reviewed pieces that are outward-looking, there's a lens and a filter that goes on that is disclosed outside an organization. The beauty of getting that information from an internal source is you get that full story. You get yourself connected to that individual. You get to hear, maybe it took 3 to 6 months for that person to solve a problem. And while you could articulate that in maybe 2 or 3 sentences, hearing how they worked through and thought through that process was, I think, really important for us to try to think about and try to get at.
But obviously there's going to be barriers, right? Like, is that, like, in your experience tapping into the internal, network of folks, what are, like, the holdups?
So there are lots of barriers here. And I've interfaced in this space, a little bit differently than Doug, but we've also overlapped quite a lot. There are some very specific, barriers. One is the size of the organization that I alluded to before, just the sheer number of folks that you are looking to engage with. There's also, in a company like Merck, geographical constraints, as I alluded to. We have sites in different time zones, in different buildings. And that makes things also, just the communication component a bit more challenging. The content that we're looking to share is also very complex, right? The many facets of drug discovery are vast and broad. And so the complexity of that content, I think, is a barrier, as is the diversity and the heterogeneity of where the information and the knowledge and the insight is coming from. It's coming from people, it's coming from teams, it's coming from databases. So that diversity is also a barrier. But I think, fundamentally, the biggest barrier, but also the most important component of all of this is the people, right? Is bringing the people that are going to be feeding into this knowledge sharing along. So there, in that sense, there are barriers with respect to the time commitment that people have to put in, the actual culture of the organization, that level of trust and communication you have with your peers, the constant change in where the focuses are and where the opportunities are within the science you're doing, and then, as kind of Doug alluded to, awareness of where the expertise resides within that organization. So there is a barrier within that whole people component of knowledge sharing, but it's so important, and I think where we're really looking to continue to move and evolve within knowledge sharing at Merck.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's worth us taking a little bit of a sidestep here, because I think we've used the words knowledge management quite a few times, and I think that's probably a term that we're used to hearing in our day-to-day work, but that maybe a graduate student's like, knowledge management, like, what is that? So can we, like, take a tangent here and maybe, Izzat, give me a sense of, like, when we say knowledge management, like, what do we actually mean?
Certainly. Yeah, this is, again, a term we've used a lot, but not a term that I necessarily dug deep into the history of. So actually, I've learned a little bit about this. It's actually a formal area of study. That's something that I did not know. There are universities that grant degrees in knowledge management. And the field of study has been around for several decades now. You know, it formally came about in the early 1990s. There's a textbook definition, and I think it's a textbook definition that resonates with me, and I think with discovery chemistry, and that's that knowledge management is really the collection of processes and methods that are associated with creating, disseminating, using, and organizing information within a group or an organization with the primary goal of enabling that organization to most efficiently and effectively reach whatever goal they have at the end of the day. So that's, you know, a very broad statement, but you know, I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's exactly how I've been thinking about it in the context of what we're doing in discovery chemistry as it pertains to coordination of some of these key elements that we wrote about in the perspective. That includes things like platforms, the literature, seminars, trainings, and consultancies, you know, all of which, you know, together allow us to retain and share knowledge and wisdom within our organization that are gained from extrinsic sources, experience from application, intuition, and insight. But I think overall, it's important to recognize this evolves over time. Knowledge management, knowledge sharing is not static. And that's something we have certainly learned and speak to, you know, in what we've done within discovery chemistry.
So I, you know, obviously there's perspectives here from across the industry, but maybe we'll focus our discussions on our approach. So Doug, in the article, you sort of kick off by focusing on our efforts that actually didn't work. And throughout the article, there's sort of this theme of, you know, history informing the future. So how important do you think it is to share those stories that were ultimately not successful, and are, you know, what are the lessons learned?
Yeah, you know, we really wanted to bear our experiences in a real way, and share what didn't work, because we felt that there really wasn't a place, there wasn't a template for us to really figure out how to make this work within our organization. Like we said before, around machine learning and artificial intelligence, there's types of data that's easy to extract, that are really passive, that can be done by computers. But trying to figure out how to make that work across an organization that's people focused is very different. And actually, the way we started out was actually much more like stamp collecting, and in which we were initially trying to think about building a wiki of static knowledge that was going to be accessible to folks. And we spent a lot of effort on that, and it was an abject failure. There were some pieces that were really good that needed to be there, like literature references around the human etherogogo channel. There's a definite and finite amount of information that is good to have shared that way. But when we tried to take it to the next level and really try to get at the more challenging types of knowledge that Isa alluded to earlier, we really struggled, because that wiki type format didn't work, because that's not what folks need. Folks need to connect to each other like you do in a graduate group, like you do when you work with your colleagues. And so we spent collectively across multiple sites several years trying to fumble through an approach that we thought was going, that we didn't know what the solution was, but we knew what the problem was we were trying to solve. And we wanted to get that out there. Pfizer and AstraZeneca and others had published in similar sorts of areas around how to try to do that. And we never saw a lot of follow-up from those publications. And anecdotally, it seemed that that they also had similar challenges as well. And what we wanted to do is to get out there after we got to what we think was relatively sustainable and share that, because the first design of that is not the design we ended up with. And we thought it was really worthwhile to share those experiences with others.
To, I guess, follow up on this, what did you two do differently this like second time around?
So when we, so after going through that sort of stamp collecting Wikipedia approach, which did not work, what we did is we drew ourselves back and actually stumbled into the pillars of knowledge management and found that to be successful. And the pillars of knowledge management are actually exactly all what you would think they would be, is having good infrastructure that's for your IT. It's driven by simple ways to capture that knowledge, getting people to participate in it, and then trying to hit that cultural element of sustainability. And when we drove it and thought about it that way, we moved from stamp collecting to creating an organizational organism focused around that sharing of knowledge. And that really pivoted the direction of where we were going, because we were no longer collecting things, we were connecting people.
Yeah, I mean, this really resonates with me, because I remember, like, I started at Merck right around the time that Wiki stuff rolled out, and there is sort of this, you know, it's like you're throwing something into a pit. It's just like it's out there, but there's no connection, and it's almost like you needed to build that sort of social networking element. So, yeah, I mean, Izzat, we've been building up to this moment. Can you sort of walk us through ultimately what we're talking about here? What's the knowledge management strategy?
Yes, I certainly can, and you know, Doug checked me on this, but I can give you kind of where we have landed now, and I want to underscore that this is evolving, right? This is where we've gotten to at this point, and I'm sure this is going to change over the next 1, 3, 5 years as we find new approaches. But Doug alluded to an organism, right? This is what we, you know, he's dubbed a people-centered organism that's focused around an easy-to-use platform. You know, in totality, this system, this management strategy coordinates and surveys what we're doing internally at Merck on our programs within our department to curate information that's relevant, that's accessible to folks in the organization, and I think most importantly to me is actionable, that you can actually get this information, get this knowledge, and then do something with it to advance your program and make an impact on your program. It's great to build that knowledge, but ideally you're able to put it to use. And so, as I mentioned earlier, this is, you know, it's built around 5 key pillars. There's our platform that's called MIKE, Merck Information and Knowledge Exchange. That is really the interface that functions as the hub for that knowledge sharing. Everyone in the organization has access to it. We get push notices coming from it. There are Monday morning reminders. So it's a really easy to use interface that has also evolved over time. This interface looks very different today than it did when it first rolled out. In it, we have shared real time lessons learned. We have questions that drive cross site discussions, and we have that archive of chemistry knowledge that folks can go back to and access. The second pillar, as I mentioned, is seminars, right? So we have a broad swath of internal seminars, both formal and informal, that are primarily leveraged to drive learning and connectivity across our department. We have consultants that I alluded to before as well, what Doug likes to call our special wizards. This has also evolved over time to a pretty robust team and group that interfaces with this overall hub and serves as both a push and a pull for knowledge sharing and expertise and engagement with the organization. We have a training component that's pillar number 4. These are typically homemade trainings that are really meant to align with the business and the science that we're doing within our organization. And those trainings, you know, grow and evolve over time, and we have new ones coming in, you know, on a monthly, bi-monthly basis. And then finally, we have the literature component, kind of that external surveying, where we have a team that continuously and in real time surveys the literature and brings it in to this hub for all to have access to. So those are the 5 pillars built around the hub. Foundational are the people and where we are right now with our knowledge sharing strategy at Merck. But again, it will evolve. It should evolve. And I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes from here. At the current state, as I mentioned, we have 20 people on this team. They come from all 5 of our discovery sites, and they are a mix of tenures, right? We have folks with a bit less tenure. We have folks where they have, you know, decades of tenure and experience in a certain topic. And there are 2 key elements to this role that I found really critical. It's an enthusiasm to be in the role and to be engaging with the organization, so that cultural component. And then there's the expertise as well. And, you know, there's a balance between those 2 that makes for an optimal subject matter consultant. The current team covers 9 or 10 topics that spans drug discovery, from structure-based drug design and physical chemical properties to PXR activation and bioconjugation. So a number of topics that are relevant to the majority of our organization. And that too has evolved over the years. The topics we have today are not the topics we started with 3 years ago. And most importantly, the team seeks to impact the pipeline through consultation, through education, and through curation of knowledge specific to the topics with to which they're assigned. So that's kind of at a high level how this team is set up and interfaces with the organization. I'd say to date, it's been going really well.
Nice. Hashtag chemistry wizards. Maybe we'll use that in the description. So maybe I'll follow that up with sort of, you know, gaining some of your examples of now that we have this knowledge sharing best practice, if you want to call it that, you know, can you think of sort of specific examples, obviously with things that we can talk about in the public realm, that you can say, you know, you've seen the impact? And maybe I'll toss it to Doug first and then Izzat second.
Sure. I think one of the spots that I think it's been really impactful, and I can speak to this firsthand, that I alluded to my unintended passions around lead identification. Lead identification is a kind of a sloppy space in discovery space because you're trying to figure out what's real and what's not real. And a large number of those activities are debunking related. And so we've really used Mike as a function, as a place to share that underrepresented kind of knowledge that exists in the organization. And when we have found solutions and ways to solve problems in that space, we've shared it on Mike. And several times over the last, so I put a post together about 7 years ago sharing around one way to get past detection interference and HTS. And over the course of the last 7 years, I've probably been pinged every 12 to 18 months by somebody else in the organization scouring Mike, looking for that information and finding that helpful to be contemporaneously helping somebody solve a similar and related problem. And it reminds me of the phrase that Mark Twain has said, is that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And if we can figure out, in particular for lead ID, we've been able to identify some of those repeatable verses, and sharing some of those lessons that have been learned have been really helpful to our colleagues, because in particular in that lead ID space, when you're trying to debunk hits that are essentially going to be invalid, that can be a really long experience. And being able to help somebody else solve that problem that you didn't even know was incurring that problem, it's been really bare fruit.
So maybe just quickly for our listeners who may not be familiar with what lead ID means, could you maybe give like a 10,000 foot view of that definition?
Sure. Lead identification is the process by which we come to one of the ways we come to the hits that we begin our discovery efforts. Lead identification, in particular in the debunking space, comes after we do high throughput screens. And there's a relatively large number of hits that we then need to deconvolute and assign both biological and chemical validation to be starting points for our programs.
Thank you. Much appreciated. So the title of this article is that has building a culture in italics, if you will, of medicinal chemistry knowledge sharing. Now, in your opinion, I guess, what are behaviors that individuals or maybe organizations should start to embrace in order to drive this knowledge exchange?
Specific to what we've done within discovery chemistry, there are a couple of behaviors that I think really help to drive this approach as well. And, you know, Doug has been a big proponent of using this word vulnerability. People need to be vulnerable. They need to be willing to say, I need help. I don't know the answer, and be willing to go and approach their colleagues to help solution with them. If you're not vulnerable, it's tough to really get deeply embedded into knowledge sharing that's going to impact you and your program. Folks need to be proactive. That's a really important behavior. They need to be willing to go and talk to people and actually share the information they have, share their knowledge proactively, as opposed to reactively waiting for someone to pull it out of them. So proactive engagement, I think, is really important. Leading by example, right? So engaging with our knowledge sharing strategy, especially with by project leaders or leaders within the organization, I think is really important. And then finally, communication of impact, I think, is critical to driving sustainability. Nothing gets people more engaged and allows an initiative to continue than showing that it's doing something good for the organization. So sharing and communicating the impact is another behavior that I like to really encourage folks to be pushing, kind of to engage with our knowledge sharing system. These are, fortunately, I don't know what the right word is, but these are not behaviors that come naturally to everyone, right? Everyone's a little bit different. So it does take time for these to develop. And I think part of that kind of getting comfortable in these behaviors are why it's taken time for us to get to this point and why we continue to evolve. But they're really critical to making this coordinated approach that we've been discussing.
Yeah, one thing about Mike that I've grown to appreciate and that I think has evolved over the past few years is the not only scientific contributions that are going on there, but also the D&I perspectives and articles and learnings there that, I think it's been a great place that vulnerability has been out there and it's been very well received, like through the comments. Yep. And everything else. So.
I agree completely. I'm seeing more and more of that as more of the organization, engages in this space.
Yeah, it took a long time to drive that cultural piece. I don't spend a lot of time on scrolling comments through the internet, but you certainly want to have a positive environment and you're not looking for internal-based trolls to spoil that cultural piece.
No trolls on Mike. No chemistry
wizard trolls. We don't
have trolls
on Mike.
That's right. That's right. Only positive and happy wizards.
Only happy trolls.
Happy trolls.
Like...
with the funny hair. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, I love those.
So, Doug, this article's really only been out for a few months now, and it's had a ton of hits, right? I think it's been, the metrics on it are like 6,000 downloads or something like that. And, clearly it's resonated with people. My own experience even on Twitter is like people are like, hey, I feel like there's this paper out there about this. People know that this is out there, right? So clearly you've struck a chord in the community. Like, what do you hope that this manuscript and ultimately sharing this with the world will inspire?
I hope it inspires people to try this. And by us getting out there and sharing how we had taken a couple different approaches and found something that we think works with us, that others can try that on for their size and their organization. A couple months ago, I gave a talk and was approached by several sets of academics where they were just super excited about one dimension of it, which was the collective sharing around and discussing around external literature. And what we're hoping is that when whatever element resonates with different organizations or different communities, to try to take on things that are that type of knowledge sharing mechanism that's not going to be easy to grab by machine learning or artificial intelligence, or they can't grab off of SciFinder or other search engines, and give themselves a chance to really go out there and do their own experiment and see what works for their organizations. Where do they really have a lot of value where they could benefit from by sharing better and trying to find a platform that works for them? We have Mike, and maybe they've got Ted. Maybe they've got Ralph. Whatever organization. Whatever.
Maybe they have Diane.
There you go, Diane.
and the one thing that's great about these things is you get to name them, right? So I think we had an episode of the pod last year where someone was like, oh, this was written about on Mike. And then Danny and I had to be like, okay, Mike's not some dude down the hall. Like, it's an actual platform.
But it is. Well, there's several Mikes down the hall. So, yeah.
But yeah, I think that internal Chem archives, the ability for that to be there, I think that resonates with a lot of folks because it's a dynamic industry. It's a and what we talked about, those folks that you interact with when you first join a group, whether it's a graduate group or a larger organization like a company like Merck, you want to be able to try to harvest out and extract some of those like really, really awesome lessons that they've learned. And be able to share that and resonate that across the organization long after people have gone. And it's important to be able to do that. For us to be able to develop our drugs faster, we can't keep reinventing the wheel over and over again. And I think that's what resonates across different companies and different folks that have read this, is that sense of contemporaneousness and timelessness of being able to archive and information that's valuable.
That's great. That's really good. All right. Well, Izzat, Doug, it was a pleasure to have you guys on the pod this week. Really appreciate your perspectives. We will link the article in our description. And if people want to reach out to Doug or Izzat, we'll share any contact information we have for them as well. Hope to have you back again someday. Thanks again for visiting us this week.
Thanks, you too, wizards. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Farm to Table podcast. This would not have been possible without our fabulous producer, Mark Partridge, and listeners like you. Be sure to check our episode credits, where you'll find more details about the show, as well as links to anything that we've discussed during the show.
If you find yourself craving even more info, you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Danny the Chemist, and LC can be found at Dr. LC Squared. But of course, our show also has a handle, and that is at Farm to Table Pod. Farm with a PH, in case you were wondering, where you'll find some behind-the-scenes action, future episodes and sneak peeks, and likely some random posts about chemistry, snacks, and whatever else.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you, so please interact with us on Twitter. Feel free to post any chemistry papers, Merck chemistry papers, that you found particularly memorable and that maybe you want us to build an episode around.
So stay tuned, folks.